That'll be teaching a course on individual and family development over the next 4 days. And I hope that it can take on the context of kind of a theory and a practice. That is, we'll talk about and I'll report on some of the current theories that people in the helping professions, such as psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and ministers, people like that get this kind of information to work with families like yourself. And we'll talk about that kind of theory as a starting point. And I'd like to do that with the conviction that, and my belief that, families, once they have this kind of information, can and do their own problem solving and their own identification of problems before they start. So I'd like to begin it with a kind of an intent that this is preventative health that we're pursuing, and that the information can be used in a positive kind of way. It's easy to see, when you see a chart or somebody's expectations of where you should be, to say, "Well, I haven't reached there yet," or it's a psychological reaction most people have when they take a course called abnormal psychology. They say, "Well, I've got that disease and I got this disease, and I'm a little bit paranoid and I'm a little bit neurotic and I'm really messed up." Well, that's somewhat true of any time you really examine emotional and developmental issues. We are all a lot of things. We're all very complicated individuals. And one further caution I would give about all of this information, and that it's still theory. And all theory does is try to take what experience is witnessed and abstract it to a universal level. And it may not apply. It may just not fit to who you are or what you may be experiencing. So if that's true, let's hear about it. Let's talk about it. Before we really begin with some of the assumptions that we're going to use, I'd like to talk about what we're going to be doing here. I'm not going to be giving you more techniques for working with a family or for dealing with a child or a situation in your family. What we will be talking about is a framework for, or developmental principles, which are thought to be universal. Okay? And behind that is the assumption that religious development cannot take place and does not take place until human development has fully taken place. That is, until a person's needs are met in a very basic kind of way, shelter, food, sense of belonging, sense of self-esteem, a different sense from simply somebody who's simply left abandoned. Until you get those kinds of impressions from your experience, you can't even begin to ask other questions, higher questions of meaning. So that this is seen to be a base, more or less, for religious development. And I think if we keep that in mind, it'll be pretty easy for you to draw parallels between developmental experience and religious experience. You know, my capacity to experience confession, my capacity to experience forgiveness, my capacity to celebrate in community has been influenced by the way in which I grew individually, in the way in which I was a member of my family. Okay. So we're going to be talking about two separate but related things. We're going to be talking about individual development, how one grows as an individual, and also the way in which a family has something to do with that. Okay? They're very different things. Another thing is that psychological and sociological research reveals that human development has a base that's applicable to all moral and emotional situations that come up in life. That is to say that your experience influences how you decide and are capable of making decisions from time to time throughout your whole life. So that insight into this can really help you in doing that. And that moral development is something that's furthered by balancing tensions between the many interpretations you can have of a single event. An example of that is that, and if we're talking about a person who is well-rounded, say an ideal person, what is an ideal person? A person who is able to perhaps stand on their own, despite the forces around them, a person who's able to celebrate community and be intimate with other people, a person who can contribute in some way, can work, can use their natural and learned gifts to generate possibilities. All of those things can enhance our idea of what an ideal person is, whatever that is. But if we talk about moral development as a movement toward what you can grow into as a person who can make those kinds of mature decisions, we can talk about moral development as being based in your family development and your individual development. Now, all this is very abstract and may sound like too much at this point, but finally, I'd like to say that family and individual development is a way to get at how we respond in the deepest levels to the meanings and the interactions around us. Okay? Well, at that point, I'd like to tell you something that an ethics professor once told me, and that's that we should decide somehow what the three most pressing issues of our time were, and that we should try to spend a good chunk of the rest of our life trying to solve one of them that we thought we could use, that we could apply our energy toward. Now, that inspired me, moved me toward getting into social work instead of into seminary, and through that process I've been fortunate enough to wrestle with some family issues and some personal issues which have forced me to grow in ways that not only is comfortable, but helpful to make me a more whole person, I think. And if there's something I would wish for you all, it's that you would begin to not always agree with what's said here, but wrestle with it and treat it as something that doesn't always fit, and if it doesn't fit, fine. Treat it as so many words and do what you need to do. What I would suggest is that nothing here is sacred, that everything is open to contention, and that my experience is just one person's experience, okay? My interpretations and these theoreticians' interpretations are just one person's experience. I hope we can foster the answers to some questions about how our family influences us. Okay, I'd like to go through just a few things of how what we seek understanding of, because I think it might help you to focus on some of these issues. I hope we seek understanding of how development is holistic. That is, it's from a lot of different directions and a lot of different parts of ourselves that we actually develop. It's not just from one part. It's not just from our family. It's not just our emotional development or our intellectual development or our physical development. It's all those things very complicatedly happening at once. And that all these things happen in a person-to-person interaction, that we don't grow unless we interact with other people. There's something that happens occasionally in the children's hospital where my wife works called failure to thrive among infants. Maybe you've heard of it. Failure to thrive happens when a baby does not get held or talked to or attended to in an adequate enough way. What are the responses? The responses are malnutrition. The responses are extremely lowered developmental pace. Normally a baby can grasp at about 6 months or so. Well, these babies can't grasp sometimes until 9 months or so. Failure to thrive. The idea is that a large part of what helps us to move ahead on the most basic levels is based upon an interaction with another human being. That's something we can lose touch of unless we are based in a community. No man is an island, is the way the poet says it. Well, that's a universal principle, and that's true of all development. Developmental crises of persons, we're going to be talking about those. Developmental crises of persons are interactional in nature, and crises cogwheel in one another. I'm going to be using the word cogwheel also. Cogwheel simply means that just as two cogs mesh together with their gears in a transmission when you're shifting gears or something like that. In the same way, our experience, our being with one another, meshes. And we affect one another on a lot of different levels. Emotionally, physically, especially if I touch you. Intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, my presence can affect you. Those are all ways in which we all affect each other. So that's something to keep in mind, that when we talk about a person in crisis, a person experiencing pain or transition of some sort, that what they're wrestling with perhaps is inner transition from one stage to another stage. And how we're present to that, or how we're distracted from that, could influence how that person works through those issues. To me, that speaks a lot about Christian community and how we can serve one another and love one another. Typical development problems expectable for individual family subsystems and families at each stage and needs at each stage. Okay, that's something we'll be looking at. Typical family problems expectable. At certain stages, certain things happen to us and create dilemmas for each one of us. And they've shown Gail Sheehy in her book Passages, Eric Erickson in his book Childhood and Society. These two books have been drawn on heavily by me and other theoreticians. The Passages book is in the bookstore, and it might help you to complement our brief look at stages to glance at that book. Maybe many of you have read them already. Further, I guess unique functions and qualities of marital subsystems of the family, whose members serve as family architects, is something we're going to be looking at. How the mother and the father and the family actually build a family? By the decisions they make, by the way in which they decide or don't decide to interact with people. We'll be talking about integrating systems theory, the way in which all systems, groups of people, interact with each other, with developmental theory as a basis for conceptualizing what it means to be healthy. And talking about what it means to be healthy. We'll also be talking about the way in which you can begin to identify what health is and what weakness is. What you may have thought before to be a real problem in somebody's behavior may be just a point at which they're struggling through a transition or something they lacked in their developmental growth that you can help them with. Okay, I've talked too much already. I want you to turn to your neighbor and try something. I would like you to talk about what is a family. What is a family? Use that word a lot. Last night at the Eucharist, you said the family of Holden. It was partaking the Eucharist. Family, what is it? See if you can come up with a definition with your neighbor. If you can turn to your neighbor now and take about 2 minutes to brainstorm. What is a family? Define it if you can. Let's begin to come back together and think for a minute about what a family is. Can you give me some images of what a family is? Just toss one out. And we can caring. Caring. One person caring? Group of people caring?
For each other? People caring for each other.
Okay.
Support.
That's
would
a
be
beginning.
Another way of saying caring.
A supportive, caring group. Okay.
A unit and the security.
A security that's provided by that supportive, caring group.
Common goals.
Common goals. Okay. Yeah, that's an aspect, certainly, of a family. What else?
A place where we're forced to practice living.
That's a wonderful definition.
Because I was just thinking, the idea that you can make family, it doesn't have to be your relation to your mom and dad, you can make up this other family we're talking about. But when we need to think of family, you're in a forced situation. You didn't ask to come into this world. Therefore, you're a forced place to practice living.
I would disagree with the person who said common goals, because I don't think, I mean, in my particular family, we all have very different goals, yet we're a very close family. And I don't think that, and in my church, for example, we have a variety of different goals among the people, yet we are close.
All right.
So I think you can have different goals.
Could that be interpreted as values?
Yeah.
But goals and values are very different terms now. They're not.
Your families don't necessarily have to be supportive of each other. In fact, you can have a family that's opposite, where they deliberately tear each other down. I think a family's two or more people with some kind of linkage.
Well, the progression of generations that brought them to this stage is all family.
But you can marry and the in-laws become family.
That's true. One of the dearest ones here.
What about a biological family versus a working relationship families that you've developed, church families, neighborhood families?
Okay.
And where you may have some common goals, but you may have different values. So there's this biological family that most all of us have of one sort or another,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere along the line.
Yeah, just to draw the
distinction. But we also have probably acquired other kinds of families.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Yeah.
Let me address that question about goals, common goals. I guess I have a vision of goals as perhaps being closer to values, and so in that sense, I apologize for the confusion there. But I think we all know families who do not have common goals, whom I would say are not families.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think you can destroy a family just as you can build a family. There's a family here at Holden, which I find for myself is characterized by a set of common aspirations, common goals, a sense of openness and honesty.
Okay. Now, we'll talk a lot more about goal-directed behavior, which is a sign of a healthy family, by the way. If a family can't solve its problems and can't get together on a way to do something together, they can't be together, right? I mean, they're going to be totally separate from one another. Now, there's a lot of things that go into that. I mean, even if it's meeting at the same time every night for dinner, and that's goal-directed behavior. There's a ritual to that. Rituals and goals and many other things are qualities that families need to have if they're going to be healthy, if they're going to really thrive, that is, nurture in a caring and fulfilling way. Just to talk a little bit about the difference between our family of origin and a family that we can create somewhere else or can become close to somewhere else. There is a process that's called reparenting, which is very important for some people who have had inadequate families, especially, or have had mediocre family experiences. Sometimes that happens within the church quite readily. People find an acceptance, a love, a deeper commitment to common goals than they ever could have experienced in their family. And sometimes a reparenting community can give a person a new direction in life, a new motivation for changing their behavior or adapting to changes more readily. Okay, well, there's a lot more things out there I'm sure we could talk about as far as definitions. And I'd love to draw on each one of them. We probably will throughout the week. There's one other question I'd like to throw out there, and I'd like you each to scribble out, if you've got a piece of paper in front of you, or if you have a neighbor who can lend you one, great. What I'd like you to do is to scribble, if possible, if not, just think about, what are my feelings about my family of origin? My feelings about my family of origin. That is, not what do I think about my family of origin. No, they are nice people. They have helped me. They have made many decisions. They have nurtured me along the way. Not what do I think about them, but feelings, okay? There's a big difference between thoughts and feelings. Sometimes you ask somebody what they're feeling and they tell you what you're thinking, what they're thinking, right? And especially, I speak from experience, males have a hard time with feelings, right? Especially in our culture, it's not acceptable to talk about your feelings. Okay, so what I'd like you to work with for a few minutes is feeling words, impressions that are left to you from your family of origin. Do I feel satisfied? Do I feel angry? Do I feel peaceful when I think about my family of origin? Do I feel anxious? Those are feelings, right?
Don't those vary with experience and time?
They sure do, yeah. Right now, let's deal with right now. This very moment, okay? Just take about a minute. And the other thing about writing or thinking is don't judge what you're thinking about your feelings. Your feelings simply are. They're not right or wrong feelings. There is no such thing as a right or wrong feeling. It simply is a feeling. You simply feel it. It's not right or wrong. Okay? So don't judge your feelings. Just let them happen, okay? Let's just take about 30 seconds of quiet time. Think about family of origin. What do I feel? Right. That's a good cue. What do you feel? Is there a word? You don't have to talk about your feelings, but is there a word that comes to your mind that...
Deep love and gratitude.
Gratitude, okay. Deep love.
Deep love and gratitude. Deep
love and gratitude, okay.
I feel warm. And comfortable.
Comfortable, okay.
Blessed.
Well, I'll botch it up.
Anger.
Anger. Lots of anger.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe even rage.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Delighted.
Delighted. Okay.
I feel lucky.
Huh. Interesting word.
How about lack of understanding?
That's a thought. Do you have a feeling about that thought?
A little bit.
What's your feeling about it?
Well, it's not complete, and it's not, it's just lack of understanding. It's
anxious.
But how do you feel about not being understood?
Bad.
Okay, that's a feeling.
Yeah. Fear.
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 Okay. That's also a feeling.
Excitement.
Okay.
What did you say?
Excitement.
Excitement.
All right.
Anybody else?
Sad.
Sad. Yeah,
memories come and there's some sadness.
Hmm.
Yeah, emptiness.
Hmm.
Joy.
Hmm. Yeah. You can both be fearful and joyful. Yeah. With the same family, huh?
Pride.
Pride. Mm-hmm. Again, we could go on and on with this. What I just wanted to point out there, number one, is the difference between feelings and thoughts. Okay. All the stuff that we'll be thinking about, the theory, is one side of what we'll be doing here. The other side is we're going to be feeling through some of it, maybe. Okay. In other words, you can do it internally. You can do it in the group. Either way. Okay. Don't be afraid to say how you feel about something that's come up. Okay. If you want to react on one level, fine. But make sure that you talk about your feelings. If you want to talk about your feelings, or your thoughts. If you want to talk about your thoughts, make sure that you understand the difference between the two, because it's very important to do that. I think it's a totally different experience. A lot of us live out of our heads. Most of us live out of our heads exclusively, and I think we kind of shrug at our feelings. Not that important, you know. Secondary source of how I work things through. Maybe it's my last source of appeal. Maybe I make my decisions most on my intellect, secondarily on my intuition about something, and thirdly on my feelings. Okay. But I guess in our families, we're feeling with these people that we're so intimate with all the time, we're feeling continuously. And we act sometimes like we don't feel anything at all. We're just simply making the decisions as they come along very cognitively, very intellectually, very pragmatically. I would submit that that's just one part of our experience, and that our feelings about something that's happening may be denied, and that may be blocking us, our effectiveness as a parent, or as a son or daughter, or as a grandparent, or as a...
You can't deny feelings.
Well, I think people
you
do
can, you can, what I'm saying is the feeling is there. You can ignore the feeling, but you can't deny its existence. It will be there whether you want to recognize it or give to see it. The feeling is going to be there.
Yeah, yeah. But I would really, yeah, concur with that.
It's the non-recognition where the problems start building up.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, that it's always influencing your behavior. Number one. And awareness is just one part of it. Number two. That if you're aware of your feelings, you can talk about your feelings. That's not the same as feeling your feelings either.
Should you act on?
Well, that's really an ethical question. That's really a hard question to crack. Sometimes you should and sometimes you shouldn't. I mean, that's something you have to work out on a deeper level. And maybe we can talk about that in terms of development. But these are two things that I wanted to begin with, because there are two things that are going to be universal throughout our whole experience here in the 4 days that we've got left, 4.5 days. That we're going to be talking about development in terms of what is our concept of a family, what do we think a family is, and what an individual is within that. And also, how do my behaviors now root back in my family of origin? Now, where is the connection there? Sometimes we do that very unthinkingly, I think, but it's a much deeper connection than we would like to acknowledge. Okay. I wanted to show you a chart that I found that I think might be useful. Excuse me. What we see here is securities, positive experiences to grow, learn, and achieve, as well as dissatisfaction, deprivation, and pressures. That environmental forces, that the context in which we live, as the person there in the middle, in the red circle in the middle, the forces all around us provide both of those in various degrees. And whatever your recipe might be for some degree of contentment and happiness, is probably determined largely by these various systems that cogwheel with each other, that always spin off one another. You see in the middle a person, and I have their structure and process. Let me just explain that for a second. Those are two terms that are used a lot by people who work with families. And every system has the quality of structure and process. That is, it has a structure, it has boundaries, it has rules by which it operates, it has a defined way in which it thinks of itself and also reacts with other things. Structure and process. Once it has a sense of itself, a structure, it still is in constant interaction with other things. Okay? So the process of interacting creates change, which is dynamic. That's why I call this dynamic life cycles, because it's continuously changing. Everything's spinning off everything else. My thoughts, my feelings, my spiritual life, whatever part of my life I want to think about is continuously being influenced by the process of interaction with other people. At the center is the person. The psyche, or the soul, was talked about by Freud in terms of three different parts. Maybe this is reviewed for a lot of you. Forgive me if it is, but I think it's a useful paradigm he used in a way of organizing it. He talked about the soul, the psyche, in terms of the id, which are the primitive drives or impulses, which are uncontrollable and which we're often afraid of. The superego, which is, or which are the demands of society, the expectations, oftentimes the parental authority figures or other authority figures which make demands upon us, and the ego, which mediates or balances between the superego and the id, the expectations of the society, the authority figures that we experience, and the primitive drives that come up from within us, right? Well, it balances that. It's the judge, it's the mediator, it's the arbitrator, okay? The moderator within us. Freud used that paradigm to talk about the personality and the way in which we all develop. He also used it to talk about the way in which our physical development influences our emotional development, our thinking about ourself, our self-concept. All the various parts of our development are keyed off of our physical development. So as we go through the cycle, the stages of development, we'll talk a little bit about the various physical changes that people are going through and how that needs to determine somewhat how they're developing emotionally, intellectually, morally, okay? And finally, you have in the middle of the body, soma, is the Latin word that's used for that. A person is made up of their psyche, their soul, their personality, and their body. I think this is a useful structure, at least for thinking about development. You have the primary family system, which is a large part of who we are, whether we want to admit that or not. It's going to influence our behavior a lot, because if it's true that all development is interactional in nature, who are the first people you interact with? Well, it's your mother, your father, your brothers and sisters. They're the people who you learn to give to receive from. That's where you get the earliest impressions of what it means to be alive, okay? The extended family system also has a large part to play. The extended family system is pretty much defined by that outer ring. It's those who you're most intimate with, subsystems, that is, littler systems, of those outside the family who are most intimately available to meet your needs. Whatever those needs may be. Again, structure and process in both the primary family system and extended family system. We have a structure. My family of origin has a definite structure. You know, certain parents, top three boys, littlest two girls. The two girls are 6 years younger than, my sister is 6 years younger than I am, and my next sister is 6 years younger than she is. So it's essentially two different families. My brother who's 5 years older than I am, my brother who's 2 years older than I am, myself, is one family. And the two girls are another family, essentially. Okay? That's not uncommon as far as a pattern of families. Okay. Alright, so you've got the immediate self, you've got the family, primary family system, and the extended family system, maybe aunts and uncles, maybe neighbors are that for you, maybe your church is that for you. It was pretty much defined all the way around, starting at the top, your macro systems, the largest systems, neighborhoods, communities, nations, institutional systems of control and policy like courts, government, law enforcement agencies, religious institutional systems, such as churches, cults, that can also be a religious institution for somebody. Or communities, church communities that is. School systems, small social group systems, associational systems, such as occupational groups or unions or professional groups. Work systems, like industry, business, and professional groups. Social and health systems, hospitals, agencies, daycare centers, that kind of thing, or recreational systems like camps and centers. That's us, Holden Village, right? There's a place for that and how that affects our life. There's a definite way in which the system of Holden, the family of Holden, will probably affect you one way or another as an individual. And if you're here with other people in your family, probably as a family as well. Okay. So let's use that a little bit now and think about what it means to begin to develop. I'd like you to refer you to this stage one, this marriage business, on page 55. Now, where does a family begin? Well, a family begins in a lot of different places. A family begins from our family of origins, in that some of us marry people very much like our mother or very much like our father. In other words, our first intimations of what it is to belong, what it is to love and be loved, can be somehow maybe duplicated in the world. And part of our energy and psyche and everything else is devoted to finding those people which meet our deepest needs. And naturally, those kinds of people might be very close to the kinds of people who raised you, nurtured you from the very earliest days. So it stands to reason that phrase, "I married my mother," or that kind of thing, would be pretty commonplace. Okay? It's not always that healthy as far as that way to interact, but it could create some problems. You can see that. Because you can't be taken care of by, like your mother took care of you by your wife. You know?
See, I told you.
So let's begin with where some families begin. Some families don't begin here, by the way, these days. We should acknowledge that a lot of common law marriages, a lot of you know, relationships, a lot of kids come out of relationships that are not in marriage, which is a whole other, you know, set of developmental situations. You can see how that would influence the whole chain of events from the very outset. One thing that marriage, you know, forces one to do is to commit to something. And it may solidify a commitment, secondary commitment to children. So that's something that you might reflect on a little bit. Let's talk about some of the tasks of a marriage. This is before children now. Mike Solomon talks about relinquishing primary gratification with the family of origin, cutting the umbilical cord, some people say. Direct primary need meeting and gratification with the spouse. Maslow talks about the four basic needs as being, first of all, food and shelter. Talks about a hierarchy of needs. Food and shelter, safety and security, belonging, and then self-fulfillment at the bottom of the list. So you can see that you can't think about self-fulfillment when you're hungry. You can't think about belonging to another person when you're not feeling safe yourself, in your own self. When you don't feel secure in yourself, you can't belong to another person. Again, I think Maslow really underlines the necessity to look at developmental issues in being with families. So a marriage has to begin to look at direct primary need meeting and gratification with the spouse. And finally, the third one there he has is implement basic male and female roles. Role behavior developmentally starts at about age 11 to 13, depending on whether you're male or female, or depending on what kind of nurturing you've gotten in your family. But somehow the sexual drives within us define the need to begin to work toward a male or female identity at those ages more and more. Now, we encourage that at younger ages. We give boys what kind of toys?
Trucks.
Oh, trucks, of course. Yeah. What else do you give little boys?
Football.
Baseballs and football helmets and footballs, right?
Cowboy hats.
And what do you give little girls?
Dolls.
Dolls and
what?
Dishes.
Oh yeah, dishes. Yeah. Gotta learn how to do the dishes. That's part of being a woman, right? You can see how the socialization process tends to make generalizations about what later behaviors are going to be. Okay? That's the only reason I said that, was that you can draw straight lines from that, those earliest experiences to the need to be that kind of person in a relationship or whatever. So, something to
can
think
I
about.
Something?
Go ahead.
If parents would give instructions and things to say within the boy's bowels, what would happen? Anything?
Good question. What do you think? Yeah.
I can remember when I was a youngster up in Michigan with our family, occasionally rains in Michigan, as some of you know, and we used to have, we boys also had little dolls, and we sewed doll clothes.
Huh.
And it, I think, certainly, I still played with trucks and things like that, and the girls also played with trucks and things like that, but I think it made me perhaps more aware, I don't know, maybe more complete. I don't think it crippled me in any way.
He can sew when he needs to.
My brothers all learned to sew, and I learned to, and all the girls in the family learned to make household repairs and how to repair electric wires and hammer and saw.
What did that do to you?
I mean, it means that I do a lot of the repairs around the house. Plus the sewing. And
so that influenced your role behavior once you got into the marriage.
It might have been better had I never learned any of this stuff.
Okay. And that's an option a lot of people come to, I guess, you know. That
I think it depends a lot on what you enjoy to do.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a good place to begin.
I have daughters who love to work with hammers and nails and things like that, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. I did. I took shop, and it was shocking when I went to school.
When we took each of our four kids to college, we had a kind of a ritual that we went through. We'd take them to college, and then we would go visit a hardware store. Get them a hammer, a pair of pliers, a couple of screwdrivers, nuts and bolts and screws and things like that.
That was girls and boys.
Girls and boys.
Initiation to taking care of yourself.
That's
huh?
Right.
You're going to need a hammer along the way.
Off us on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well,
sewing machine is handy too.
So yeah, just to draw that up a little bit, that you act out your male and female roles as they've been socialized into you and as you've learned how to behave in certain contexts. Okay?
It's a good book on that over here at the bookstore called Raising a Child in the 80s.
Hmm. Okay.
That addresses the role thing.
Who wrote that?
I don't know. I'll go and get it. I've got it.
You've got it.
Lenny Cotton Pogrip. And
oh, good.
It's
all
really
right.
Called Growing Up Free, Raising a Child in the 80s.
All right. Good. Thank you for that reference. Yeah. So we act out male and female roles. As they've been nurtured or socialized and learned. And a major concern that Solomon talks about is establishing and negotiating ways to meet each other's, look at this list, sexual, economic, social, and psychological needs. Well, that is quite a list. Okay? That's meeting the big three that they talk about being the major problems, you know, in any relationship, and it's very close to the three traditional callings to take on celibacy and the life of a priest, and that's money, sex, and anger. The priest vows to follow chastity, and the nun vows to follow chastity, poverty, and obedience. And that directly addresses those three big things, money, sex, and anger. And those are basic things that you have to address. You know, how are you going to meet those needs? You've got to wrestle those three big ones, okay? And if you can't do that, something's going to be hurting. Something's going to be festering, right? Thank you. Okay, it's Growing Up Free, Raising Your Child in the 80s. This is what it looks like. It's a big, thick book. But just let me say along the way here that parenting books are wonderful. If for no other reason than to give you a shot in the arm and make you think about something differently. You know, get some objectivity, some distance from your everyday experience. There's a wonderful book by the McGinnises called Parenting for Peace and Justice, which I would also recommend with this. I haven't read this, but looks, from what you said, looks like it could address some issues.
I don't recommend the whole book. There's parts of it I do not agree with, but I am over 70 years old. That makes a difference.
Bless you.
Hmm. So you're selective about it.
Yes, yeah. Some things that I can wholeheartedly agree with,
uh-huh.
but I don't agree with the book, with the chapter on sex at all.
Huh. Okay. Jan.
Just in my own experience, I didn't read more than one or two books, and I used that as a way to judge my parenting rather than get more information.
Huh.
So to read more than one, like four or five, and get a more well-rounded idea of what is adequate parenting
uh-huh.
is important.
Yeah, and it serves you to think about your family of origin.
Yes.
Then, okay. Hey, it works both directions. And that's somewhat of what I wanted to address in that those opening questions, is that I hope our thinking about development goes both directions, you know, both to our family of origin and also ahead to our family that we're now. That's a good point. Let's just quickly go through the list that Sonia Rhodes gives us here for the first stage. What happens in a marriage? The tasks she talks about is investing in a marriage, realistically perceiving a partner as opposed to idealistic notions. How much do you need to idealize, romanticize the relationship in order to stay in it, or in order to be married in the first place, to think you can make it in an age when divorce is 50% plus? Okay? You've got to be pretty idealistic to think that you're really going to make it these days. I mean, it's not the case for all of you, I'm sure, that that was the divorce rate when you were married.
I disagree with you.
Okay.
I think you got to be more realistic, that you've got to make a commitment beyond just the ideal, we're going to get married and have an idyllic situation.
Mm-hmm.
But when the fun is gone, there's in fact still going to be a marriage here that we're, or not when the fun is gone, that isn't what I really mean. Blood is not gone, sweetheart. You know, when the honeymoon's over and you know, you get down to the reality of yeah. you know, you've made that commitment for the life,
uh-huh.
but there are going to be things realistically that you have to deal with that are not going to be pleasant.
Yeah.
And so, idealically, mm-hmm. is one way. I don't think you've got to look.
But there's another way to get at that question. Okay. Did you live together before you were married?
No.
Okay.
They knew each other 2 weeks and they loved.
8 days.
Okay,
yeah. So you really didn't know what it was like to live with her. You had no realistic notion of what it was like to use the same medicine cabinet. And
my daughter will do that either.
Right? So that's, I guess, what the point is there.
Yeah.
You know. And some people have tried to bridge that gap by living together before they're married, or by staying in a relationship much longer before they're married. Most people that I know that have gotten married over the last 2 years have known each other for 3 or 4 or 5 years before they got married.
But the interesting thing is, statistically, if you look at people who are living together, the probability is that they live more than 1 year together that...
Without being married.
Without being married. If they become married, there's a much higher probability of divorce. Conversely, in the traditional relationships, if you are engaged for more than a year, the probability is it's not going to be successful either. So there appears to be...
Statistically, do you have a reference on that? Or?
I don't have it here, but I've read them. And so at least it appears to me that that familiarity breeds some kind of... well, I wasn't going to quite say that. But.
You know, we've been together for four and a half years or five.
Remarkably mm-hmm. high.
The
yeah.
common sense thing I heard one a long time ago was to be sure that you like the person you marry as well as love them.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of true.
I think to get back to this, we're asking for a degree of retrospection, I think, that is, having had 4 children and gone through some of these steps with them, which is, I think, unrealistic at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are, however, I think, aids for this kind of thing. Most pastors have a counseling program that they work with the couples coming in.
Mm-hmm.
there is something called engaged encounter, where they spend time talking about in-laws and
the four things,
children and things like that, potential stresses, and that's more of a decision making place. And it's interesting that many couples who go through that kind of an operation, in fact, decide not to get married.
Mm-hmm. It's as often true as not for the engagement encounter.
Yeah,
and I think that's a healthy process.
Yeah, they talk about things which. It's a structured situation in which they talk about things that they wouldn't have, in fact, haven't talked about. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really what they're talking about here when they say realism versus the illusions you have about the person or the idealistic notions you have about what it means to be in a marriage. Mm-hmm. My parents were married all my life, so I know I'm going to be. You know, something inside you never questions that. And so you need to reevaluate that. Well, that's one of the tasks they talk about here. A third task.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
In light of the now of the writing of marriage contracts and changing vows to as long as we both shall live to as long as we both are in love, that would tend to, that social change would tend to lead to a less lower expectation on a lifelong relationship.
Yeah.
And destroy them.
Yeah.
It used to be that divorce just was not an option.
Mm-hmm.
And those marriages worked because they figured that.
No. Those marriages lasted. They may not have worked.
Well, that's right. Okay.
Good point.
But if you always think, well.
But what do you mean by worked, Doris? What do you mean by worked?
Well,
what?
That they usually worked through their problems. They didn't quit.
Yeah.
Because they figured, well, divorce is not an option, so let's solve this thing. Let's cope with our problems. Let's work through them instead of just quitting.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the easy way out.
There are some advantages to that.
I think too often though, my aunt and uncle are a case in point. The marriage lasted, and my uncle finally died, and my aunt was then free. For the first time
well,
in
course,
many,
there are
many
some
years.
That stick together who shouldn't stick together. I'll certainly admit that. But I think there are many who, if they would just work through those first problems, I think almost any marriage could be dissolved at one time or another.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Sure. If you're not going to sit down and work through that thing, it's so much easier to say, let's forget it. This was a mistake in the first place. That's the easy way out.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've got to realize that these days, with that kind of statistic of 50% plus, that dramatically changes the way in which men and women relate in marriage. Dramatically changes it. I mean, you know that there's always that option.
Absolutely.
There's an exit door.
But I think a lot of it's our own fault. I mean, speaking as a middle-aged person, of giving children everything their little hearts ever desired, and of making sure that they didn't have to work out any of their problems.
Immediate
gratification. Make any mistakes. Right, I see so many parents who don't want their children to make any mistakes that they so shelter them. I worry, I teach first grade, and I really worry about some of those little kids that say, I want, Mom, I need a computer. And boy, next day that kid's got a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, I need a new bike. I got a flat tire. And the next day that kid has a new bike. Yeah. What happens to that kid when they get out in the real world?
The difference between instant gratification and delayed gratification. Yeah.
And will they ever be able to work any problems out?
And that's a very important principle in parenting that you need to keep in mind, keep before you, is that, you know, what is going to be the outcome of this behavior and this person's way of interpreting the way it is out in the real world? Because when they leave the immediate family relationship, they're going to have to deal with that same problem on their own level. Right?
I teach kids whose, you know, the parents' big punishment is send them to their room where they have their own TV and all their toys. It's a big punishment.
Okay.
Do they have an oatmeal?
That's one reason why a lot of problems come in when the children go first to school, right? Because that's the first time that the big test comes. Did the reality in the home fit with what's happening out in the real world and the reality in school? Did the expectations that the teacher makes on the child mesh in any way, and the other kids make on the child mesh in any way with what the adults expect of the kid? No. In the home. What happens there? You know? unless the mother or the father are taking time to think about how they're interacting and how that determines what that's going to mean for the way in which that child interacts in the future with other people, it's going to really deter that child's ability to work through and solve their own problems when they're out in the real world. Quote, real world. Right. Let's get through the rest of these. It's already past time, so I don't want to keep you too long. Negotiate the differences in conflict with one another. In other words, hanging in there. That's another notion that we've been talking about. Find mutually satisfying ways to support and nurture one another. You know, another way to say that is, what presses your buttons? Positively and negatively. What do you really enjoy doing? Betsy and I have found out in the last year or two that unless we get out and dance or roller skate or do something vigorous, physically vigorous with our bodies together, that we're not having a good life together. You know? That it's like a necessity that presses our buttons positively. You know? There are ways we learn how to press each other's buttons negatively too, right? You learn that pretty quickly too when you live with somebody for very long. You know, I'm going to withhold my reaction to that comment because I feel too strongly about it. Well, that raises feelings in Betsy when I withhold, when I don't talk about what I'm thinking or feeling. Right? Or change the subject or walk away and do something else. Okay? Presses buttons, right? Something's happened there that makes me angry, so I withhold. That's the way in which I deal with my anger. Not a very useful way to deal with anything, right? But that's what happens, okay? And we all have buttons that get pushed in relationships. And I think that learning how to meet one another's needs in mutually satisfying ways is really the key. You know, you notice some people that are so dominant in a relationship, you wonder how that relationship can survive. So, you know, the husband bosses that woman around everywhere. Or the wife bosses the husband around everywhere, right? You wonder how they're meeting one another's needs in a mutually satisfying way. But each one of those people are getting something out of that behavior. They're getting something out of it. What's the payoff for that person, you could ask? A sixth task is confronting disillusionment and disappointment of expectations by sharing dissatisfaction and self-identified needs. And finally, the concerns that Rhodes identifies there are vying for power positions, assigning roles and responsibilities, projecting onto one's partner in an attempt to avoid anxiety.
What does that mean?
Projecting. Okay, let me just talk about that for a second. I know the bell rang. Projection means I am taking my feelings about a situation and actually giving them over to something else.
You mean dumping?
Well, it's not quite the same as it could be closer to blaming than dumping. Okay.
Is it instead of recognizing something I see in myself, I find it in another person?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That it's the other person's fault you feel that way.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Finding escape.
Yeah. I am.
Sorry.
It's characterized by you statements, huh? You statements. Why did you do this to me? Huh? Yeah. Instead of dealing with what do I feel about this and what do I want to do about it. So it's a reactive statement instead of a proactive statement. Okay, what I'd like you to think about tonight is just some of these things and how they relate both ways. To my family of origin and to what I'd like to create or what I have in my marriage. Okay? This has been fun. Thanks.
What should we do with these?